Sorry for the preamble, but Johnny, I feel such joy from you, and just I'm just so happy that you're here. I know you're going to give your own kind of content warning, but I'm going to, if it's okay, just read your intro, because those who haven't seen, heard it yet. I just love the way that you've written it. So Johnny Profane has submitted this to us, and it is on our website for later reading pleasure. Johnny Profane, 67, pretend rock star, because it's all cosplay. I was born before autism was invented, more or less. 1953. Long before autism made the scene in medicine or pop culture, I've been here for the whole movie. I can hear your voice in my head right now. been a meditation teacher, a cult member, typesetter, editor, magazine publisher, ad agency owner, marketing veep, non-profit activist, three-time grad student, three-time husband, homeless, mental health counselor, substance abuse counselor, cult counselor, homeless, singer, songwriter, homeless, fast food clerk, pretend rock star. So, I have no credentials to offer, at least none that matter to me anymore. So I offer my life. I get chills when I read it. And thank you for sharing of yourself, and everyone enjoy. I'm so pleased to introduce you to Johnny. I think that the rest of the community needs to see and hear more of you. So I'm so glad that you're here, Johnny. Thank you so much for being a part of the Intersectional Infinity Summit, and I'll turn it over to you.
I want to thank you. I think we'll see how this goes. The truth of the matter is, guys, I perform. I don't do much live. I have situational mutism, selective mutism, whatever they're going to call it, whenever they're going to call it. So doing more than a couple sentences that are new, pretty struggle for me. So like Meryl Streep, you know, I got a script. I do want to let you know, according to Grammarly, I dropped 1.5 F-bombs in this. And there was a shit that got through, okay? The other thing is I touch on a couple of topics. I don't go into detail on this stuff, but I talk about bullying. I talk about sexual abuse. And, look, those are the big two. There's other stuff. So just know that before we begin. The other thing is it's a little bit long. This was supposed to be video for a little bit more, you know, protection here. And I read a little slower than I managed to get it on, you know, on YouTube. So anyway, we're going to go now. You ready, guys? Hi, I'm Johnny Profane, and I'm an old white he-him, pretty much. Heterosexual, at least when I'm in love, and, you know, autistic. So today, I'm jumping up and down with excitement because I'm here as a recovering class clown. Getting to talk back to teachers, if I'm lucky, there's one or two here, maybe a couple parents, in front of a class of my peers on April Fool's Day. It doesn't get better. It doesn't get better. Two thoughts. This could end up like a Jerry Springer episode. And, you know, I think I actually forgot the second one. But I imagine it had something to do with why I could be relevant to a summit on intersectionality. Look, guilty as charged. I had every advantage. Everything our biased society favors. Race, gender, high-achieving professional parents, gifted IQ, whatever, we'll come back to that. Education, decent looks, we're not going to brag, but decent looks. Heterosexual presentation back then, mostly. But here's the thing. That's the very reason red alerts should be going off, should have been going off my entire life across everybody's screen. Because with every privilege handed me, I failed to thrive. Big time. Big freaking time. My longest job, 2 years. Out of dozens of jobs in 45 years working. not what you call a productive citizen, but I do have a knack for telling certain kinds of stories. So I'm here to explore a whole nother continent of the intersectional map, the continent of invisible disabilities. And I'm not going to name them all because there's a lot of us out there suffering these things. But I'm your ambassador from the country of articulate autism, selective mutism, gifted kids, PTSD, a couple of others, some of them a little embarrassing. And our citizens of color, our envies, our intellectually challenged citizens, I can't really tell their stories. But here's my story, because it's the only one I know. And I've heard and read and written and podcasted and hung out on Twitter enough. I've come to believe something deeply. All we autistics share something basic, fundamental. So every one of our stories strikes a universal chord in our community and anybody who wants to visit our community. So when I'm done with mine, after a couple of tears, a laugh or two, whatever, I can only leave you some of tears, like mouseketeers, in silence to imagine the stories of similar autists who can't tell you their stories because intellectual disability, because not speaking, because racial and gender barriers, and every other invisible disability I'm leaving out. But most of all, because we're invisible to you. Because of all those invisible biases we all learn as kids in this biased society. I got three short stories. Put them together, somehow they tell one big story, like Aristotle's beginning, middle, and end. My beginning, I want to give you the experience of autistic joy, because that's the bedrock of everything for autistic folks. And I want you to really get in your gut what the power of your educational leadership could unleash. If we find a way to fan those flames without setting fire to the classroom. Okay, so the middle, the conflict. A bit about why my personal learning style didn't work for me in the system, basically. And how I hope for better for today's neurodiverse kids. Then there's the bitter end. A day in the real life of my high school. Some good, most bad. So that's the storyboard. But you guys have seen Pulp Fiction. You know it's more fun if I tell you out of order. You know, like beginning and maybe the middle. Making you connect the dots. Enough of this shit. Here we go. Ooh, there we go. I just went up. So I'm at the Shalom Center in Bloomington, Indiana, college town. Trees, cute shops, parking meters to discourage the riffraff. I'm in line for a free breakfast. Looking down the long queue toward the steam table. Damn, all the instant oatmeal's gone. I mumble out loud a lot. That shit settles my stomach. See, I just got off the ancient bus that the Genesis Project works as a shuttle. They used to run a warming shelter for the homeless. We hang out there and sleep on cots in a large tent, 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., March to November. And yes, I just said homeless. The rest of the day, we're on the street. I usually hung out at the library, internet. But they kick you out if you're caught napping, meditating too. That was embarrassing. But right now, the library's about a 6-block walk, breakfast, and a public shower away. The next guy in line looks like he just woke up in the early 70s. Army fatigues, a knit dread cap over scraggly gray hair. Thin guy. Must have heard me cuss out the oatmeal. Yeah, depends on donations. He doesn't look at me. Directly, I guess. Little bird glances at my face, at my hands. The good stuff comes and goes. Yeah, sounds like, you know, life. Okay. I was a wannabe class clown, but it did help me survive second grade. Okay, guys? The white Rasta warrior stares right into my eyes, real fast, quick peer, then goes hazy a moment, like he's lost inside. Then he cracks the goofiest grin I ever saw on the street. You're okay. He shuffles down the line. I shuffle right behind him. You too, guy. I like homeless folks. I never understood social status anyways. Maybe because I am autistic. Most homeless don't pay attention to it either. Bob Dylan wrote about the street, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Homeless, no. Everyone's just a pink slip away from nothing to lose. Me and Rasta end up at the same round lunch table, wobbling awkwardly back in the corner. We're wrapped in vinyl floors and cement walls. It's like a cold crypt. I'm Johnny. I reach out my hand. Been on the streets a couple weeks. He disappears inside. Comes back with another smile. My name is Theo. I've been on the streets off and on. You know what? Let me try that again, because, man, he didn't talk that directly. My name is Theo. I've been on the streets off and on since grad school. As I remembered, he'd set off to be a psych researcher, cracked up before his orals. We had a lot in common. We swapped grade school war stories a while. This was way more fun than Dodge and crabby librarians. So we hung. We got into what a blast it is just to discover new shit. Any new shit. Academic shit. Any shit. If it was cool, you know? You know, I never wanted to teach. He blurts out in the middle of my best story, okay? He's autistic. Who knows? Then he looks away. Or run a department. Just research. Use my brain. But the weird thing. A man, a few words and many pauses. I have jobs sometimes for a while. But I don't like the ones where I use my brain. I like the repetitive ones. I like factories. Janitor. I can think. I'm in a different place. And there it was. Two homeless, both crazy, more than likely, both failures, demonstrably, certainly neurodivergent. He knew it. I didn't yet. But here we were, strangers, talking joy, openly, unashamedly, first time in our lives, in a homeless center. It was a strange moment for me, a shock of recognition. But it took 4 years more before I permitted myself to let it sink in. 4 years on a diagnosis, by the way. I'm coming back to Theo and the Shalom Center in a bit. But first, you need to hear this flashback, okay? Just like Pulp Fiction. If you want to get autistic joy, if you want a genuine aha moment, and I want you to take a moment to think whether you want to smother that autistic spark or fan those flames. So, quick, I got no special effects. Here we go. Screen title, Autistic Joy. What are you doing? My former mother's voice was sharp. I'm spread-eagled on the backyard grass, facing down. I've called you 3 times. She's annoyed. What are you doing? I don't know it in second grade. But I have difficulties shifting attention when I'm focused. So I try to replay the last few moments, listening to, then interpreting anything she might have said while I'm in that focus bubble. I'm 7. Rewinding the tape is already automatic for me. A never-ending attempt to comprehend what's going on. Anytime around, people. Checking for verbal mistakes, mixed social cues, guessing if they meant what they said, or were just mocking me again. Anyway, I'm still in the grass, sorting it out, choosing my words carefully to avoid trouble, clearing my throat, moving my sleeping tongue, loosening my jaw, just about ready to speak. Hey, what are you doing? Nothing. Close as I come to lying at that age. I've been in the backyard an hour or so, gloriously alone. See, Johnson City had this great hobby shop, all kinds of cool science toys, and I'd saved up my 50-cent allowance for weeks to buy what the red and yellow package promised, a real handheld glass, magnifying glass, with all metal handle. I was squinting through it, entranced, examining grass leaves, dewdrops, and ants. Dozens of ants, one after another. Antennae, mandibles, eyes, guiltily burning off the occasional leg with focused sunlight. Endless fascination. No time, no place, no words. I was in the flow. Okay, whatever you're doing. I wait for her command that will end my bliss. Stop doing it. It's time for lunch. I sigh, roll over, and trudge in. Hardly sounds like abuse, right? You know, the thing is, autistic joy is hard to explain, like to pretty much anybody who's non-autistic. Imagine that last delicious dream you're enjoying as you drowse in a warm, snuggly bed on a lazy Saturday morning when you don't have to get up. Then, out of nowhere, someone screams, "Get up!" You're so startled, for a second, you don't know where you are, what you're doing, the time of day, the season. Now imagine that every damn day, many, many, many times a day. Torture, right? Being startled out of the flow, it's like that. Whether you're a kid or an adult, you dig? That's as close as I can come to explaining autistic joy. That same joy you see on the face of an autistic kid, dancing endlessly, unashamed, in a sprinkler, in the sun. Lost to the world, found in himself. If I had to guess, this is precisely what being in the moment, in the now, means. I think that is where I spent most of my childhood. When I wasn't reacting to family, schoolmates, parents, teachers, the few humans I let into my life back then. Gradually, as I aged, these blissful moments became fewer and fewer, further and further and further apart, nearly gone. First, I was forced into a school system that I was clearly not wired for. Rigid, lockstep, regimented, regulated, scheduled, boring, with no free time to be me, autistic me. Later, of course, it got much worse. Jobs, relationships, finances, life in modern adult America. Listen, I don't want to be a downer, but I had a stress-induced stroke at 30. Then, nearly three decades in the therapeutic system. I worked with maybe a dozen pros. They couldn't sort out what was mental disability, what was trauma, what was bad attitude. Neither can I. All I know as it is, as a kid, I was either happy exploring or I was being forced to don my personality. To me, that means arbitrary vocabulary, facial expressions, body language, polite responses, and social lies that most humans demand. Just so it's easier for them to predict how I'll behave, so they can be comfortable around me. Most humans project a personality I'm having a little trouble, guys. Give me a second. I'm going to take a drink. God, I wish that was vodka. Most humans project a personality automatically. But for me, it was like being dragged out of my comfy pajamas and forced into the most cumbersome, restrictive, awkward, embarrassing winter coat, earmuffs, muffler, heavy snow boots, and mittens your mother ever stuffed you into to get on that kindergarten bus. So I got two choices, dancing in joy or shackled in chains. You choose. And I'm not the only autistic who felt that way about childhood or freaking school. From age two on, I clearly remember long waking periods without any verbal thought, just perceiving in awe and wonder everything. Until I had to interact with humans, any humans, even those I was required to love. But when that personality switched on, the joy collapsed, not into pain, collapsing into an all-absorbing effort, intellectualizing over every word, gesture, tone of voice of my own, and then interpreting all those of each and every human I was with. And then carefully weighing precisely the right word, the tone of voice, facial expression, and body attitude to project all at the same time to avoid being in trouble. Plus, even at a young age, I had a growing sense of the need to protect others from me every single second. Because I was different, arrogant, hurt people without understanding. Because I was bad. So when this autist entered school, I brought two things: the capacity for bliss and fear of shame. Over the years, the flow, the bliss, got lost. The shame hung around like a fart in a closed classroom. I've written about how I worked to regain autistic joy, much of it common sense, rest, nutrition, reducing social contact and sensory stimulation, relaxation techniques. But the thing that's important to this story is how I've rewired my thinking on my special interests. A medical term that stinks of sickness. Some autists are trying different language, like specializations. They're not a forbidden pleasure, a shameful quirk, something I waste time on when there's nothing more important to do. They're my guiding passions, my gateways to bliss, transcendence, oneness, my reason for being, my job. That spring day on the lawn in Johnson City, I saw infinity in a burnt off ant leg. And eventually I went for it. Now there's a significant pause and we go, meanwhile, back in Bloomington. Theo and I aren't talking about bliss in school 50 years later in the homeless shelter. We're talking about schoolyard bullies, talking bullying teachers, and school systems with only two tracks. Counselors either shoehorn kids into college and professional careers, or reassured us the world really needed more mechanics and beauticians. Theo shared that he was a wreck long before he hit grad school, grammar school, high school. So stressful, he basically slept most of the time, recovering when he wasn't there. Later, jobs were the same for him. Me? Here's my story. Imagine a title screen. You're not that smart. I'm heading out the door of algebra. Mr. Connor gestures. Come here. Yeah, I shuffled, slumped. Shoulders, whatever. Attitude. What? I've seen your records, your test scores. He leaned in. You know, he did that shifting his glasses to the top of his head thing. He meant business. I don't believe him. You're not that smart. Ouch. I don't even like reading this to you. Look, I'm going to give you a day in my high school life, okay? Not really one day, a mishmash of days to make a story. Here's some background. Kindergarten, teachers I had two, both told my mother I was unusually creative and maybe smart. First grade, I was that kid who always raised his hand first. That's what my parents told me to do. And it actually worked for a while. But by the end of second, teachers weren't digging that raised hand thing so much. I never sat still. I never stopped talking. And I was well on my way to becoming a class clown. I read all my textbooks the first month. So, you know, I got bored. The first time I made a comment that cracked the class up, it was all over. Then, with my luck, the results of my first IQ test came in. Off the charts, Stanford-Binet, you know. There was shock. Parent-teacher meetings. But my parents fought me skipping grades. It was a philosophy for them. And my poor parochial Catholic school had no other enrichment programs. The end results? I got labeled a smartass. Technical term, turns out. Honest. They showed me my permanent record. Scared the shit out of me. By third grade, Mrs. Leonard was one of a long line of teachers who bullied me into submission. Basically, that's when I started to shut down. Long, long before this day in high school. I want to dash down the hall to beat the bell for algebra. I dodge two guys and a girl who think it's funny to try to trip me. But tight end Steve, he body checks me, shoulder to shoulder. My books go everywhere. Hey, what happened to your shirt? An eruption of girlish giggles. Two periods ago, some seventh grader had screamed, fairy loop, fairy loop, and ripped the loop off the back of my Madras shirt. And they were a big thing in the 60s. Left a big hole. I say nothing, but my teeth are grinding. I feel nauseated again. I make it into class. Maybe we were doing quadratics. I don't remember. Because 5 minutes, I'm fighting sleep. You know, as usual. I use all my tricks. I try staring at the sweeping red second hand of the class clock. You know, seeing how long I could hold my breath. Nothing spectacular, maybe a minute 50. After about 10 minutes of trying to set a record, I switched to counting my heartbeats. See, I was reading yoga philosophy, Krishnamurti, Yogananda. I wanted to see if I could slow my heartbeat, you know, like yogis do. Seems like I remember getting it from about 80 to 60. That actually made the time fly for a while. Then I'm doodling. I used to do these weird maze-like patterns of intricate intersecting lines, pages of them. My hand would cramp holding the big pen. Mr. Knapp. The whip cracked from the teacher's desk. I glanced at the chalkboard. C squared. I was right. What are you doing there? He doesn't care I'm right, which never makes sense to me because it's never about being right, even when I'm wrong. I think better when I'm doodling. Caring, you know about that. Well, in my class, learn to think without doodling. Okay, Mr. Connor. So I go back to counting my breath. On the way out, he corners me. You're not so smart. My memory is a little hazy, but replaying the scene as an adult, I believe he wanted to motivate me. My quizzes were sloppy, lots of mistakes. He thought I was a lazy kid who wasn't as smart as I thought I was. He probably was right. You think things come easy to you. He glares a moment. You got a drill. Like any student, you actually got a drill. Drilling was big with him. He didn't know it, but I was barely functioning. All I heard was, "You're not smart." That evening was the first time I remember considering suicide. I'm sorry, guys. It is hard to perform this. That evening was the first time I remember considering suicide. A few years later, I tried the first time at 17. In seventh grade, I left a substandard parochial school in Minnesota. My father took a job in New York, and that made me the new kid in a well-funded public system in a wealthy suburb of New York, just as the puberty hormones were hitting, and kids my age were splitting into cliques. But I'm a stranger, weird, a loner, awkward physically, God knows socially. The peer bullying was horrific for years. When I say my previous school was substandard, I was 6 months to a year behind in coursework for my grade level when I transferred. But one science teacher really believed in me and fought for me to enter the honors track, which meant they had already covered all of seventh grade math before I joined them. And that was the second semester. So I had to learn all of seventh grade and the first month of eighth instantly. They just handed me textbooks and told me to catch up. There was a certain amount of resistance to me being moved ahead, shall we say. No tutors, no review classes. Just go read. I was fucking overwhelmed, okay, guys? Who cares what my IQ was? So old man Connolly, he really popped my cork. A rage meltdown, days of recovery, absent from school, sick. We used that a lot. I almost had to repeat fourth grade because I was sick so much. After years of this, I graduated in the top 10 of my class. I aced every aptitude test. I went on to grad school, many attempted careers. But no one, I mean, not one educator thought I lived up to my potential. Because not one of them knew I functioned at best a couple days a week. In and out of incapacitating depressions, frustrating bouts of not being able to speak under stress, that selective or situational mutism, inability to meet deadlines, prioritize tasks, and on and on and on. Between the natural differences of my autistic mind and the effects of an abusive childhood, and frankly, my social, sexual, and educational abuses in school, this is all the potential I had left. Meanwhile, back in Bloomington, okay, Theo and me, working on our third styrofoam cup of tea. Theo doesn't offer similar stories. He said he couldn't talk about things like that, not to others. He couldn't relive it. But it became clear we shared a lot of traits. I'd say the two of us were more process-oriented than goal-oriented. He loved imagining test designs, trying to operationalize hypotheses, writing up papers, or prepping for orals, for that matter. He kept putting them off. For me, it was finding sources. I was a great grad assistant. I loved spending hours on LexisNexis, but I flunked out of two programs for, you know, incompletes. We still there, guys? I hope so. Theo felt he learned all the best stuff out of school. I totally yes-anded him. I said, I've never learned well from another human being. I'd rather steal from their example when they're not watching or invent something for myself. Theo brought up self-paced computer-assisted education. I didn't feel like I was competing with teachers anymore, which blew my mind. I never thought why there was always that sense of friction when I worked with a teacher or a mentor or guitar instructor. There is something, maybe not competition, maybe status or power or something else I didn't get. So maybe I'm a freak example, just a guy who couldn't make the American education system work for him a long, long time ago, a generation far, far away. But then there's that universal chord, those startling autistic similarities across generations, across nations, intersections. So I'm going to end this part of the tale with a snapshot of what education could be for an autistic child, no matter what their tested capabilities. If we can just find a way to tap into their autistic joy and their passions without doing damage. Okay, we're getting towards the last imaginary title screen, Orgasmic Learning. This is the middle, the good stuff. What the fuck was that? Okay, so I'm in fourth grade, still in Catholic parochial school. Never said any such thing back then. But it's a precise transcription into adult ease of what I felt. I get excited. I wave my arms. I start bouncing on my butt up and down on the sofa in front of the coffee table. I'm breathing hard. I'm gasping. I shudder and I moan. A weird, high, pleasure, pain moan. My head snaps back. My eyes close. You know, like good sex that first time. A flash of bright, white light. My eyes jerk open, but I can't see anything through blinding fog. Slowly, the room fades back into focus. That's the day, the exact moment. Autistic as fuck, dot me, got addicted to learning. I mean a hardcore, dope sick, sell your dog to get well, learning junkie. Because after 2 hours alone, frustrated, pulling my hair out and staring at the follicles, anxiety, trying to wrap my grade school brain around binary numbers, it suddenly snapped into focus. We're going to talk autistic joy again. Like some autistic characteristics, it's a lot like what many humans experience already, amplified and turned just 5 degrees toward different. All kids love learning new things, at least the ones that interest them. But there's something unique about the joy many autists feel learning. And I don't mean school learning. I mean exploration on your own, teaching yourself. If you've ever known an autistic child or an adult, for sure you've witnessed it. A kid jumping up and down, waving his arms, repeating the same phrase over and over, giggling in a library, knowing he must be quiet. But he just found a new book on Gigantoraptor filled with detailed illustrations. And they got the feathers right. He's gonna explode. Junior high was full of names for this. Nerdgasm, spaz out, geeking out, being a dweeb. I have no idea what they call them now, 50 years later, but, you know, that's what we used then. Let me tell you about my most intense buzz. It was just after my 10th birthday, 1963. I pestered my parents for weeks for one present, a Digicomp 1. It was a real, functioning binary computer made from plastic that you cranked, I mean, by hand. I had to have one. See, Boy's Life, the Cub Scout magazine, carried a full-page ad on this mechanical computer. And I always thought arithmetic was just stupid memorization. Don't get me wrong. I tried hard to conquer every task they handed me. I always did. I was driven to be a good boy, to please parents and teachers. But I've never been able to fight my nature, no matter how good my intentions. I fight my nature always wins. Zero interest equals zero effort throughout my life, like a lot of autists. Anyway, we just begun base 8 arithmetic in school, all a rage for a year or two, like all the other 17 incarnations of new math since then. Because programming, the career of the future. And everybody knew modern computers thought in base 8, which they did for a few years. Maybe I was a bright kid, but I could simply not make the switch to base 8 from base 10, except through grinding memorization. And I had hated multiplication tables. Mindless. Until I realized I could play tricks, sneak up on answers easier and faster. Say 9 times 7. It's really just 10 times 7 minus 1 7. So it's not 70, it's really 63. If I could make a game of something, like doing squares in my head, it was fun. Learning from a teacher? Not so much. But I could not think my way out of making this switch from counting 1 to 10 to counting 1 to 8. Total block for weeks. So DigiComp was my Hail Mary pass. I'd get the computer, program it, then polish off my homework without suffering. Get parents and teachers off my back. More time for growing my paramecia in pond scum, or squeezing maximum altitude out of my pump-action water rockets. You know, cool stuff. So here I am, sitting in front of my last hope, my own real computer, that I put together on the coffee table. But it actually takes work to understand and program the thing, even if it did come in a geek box. More work than base 8 was in the first place. Throbbing headache, taut nausea. I start beating my temples with my fists. You know, these numbers. I can't believe this. I'm way smarter than this. The other kids are getting it. And I'm way smarter than they are. I'm alone in the house. I let out this guttural scream. Aimed right at the instruction. Okay. I'm looking at 4 sets of 1. I mean, it felt personal. Like someone was doing this to me on purpose. I'm looking at 4 sets of 1s and 0s. 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. The 1 means 1. Okay, I got that. But add 1 plus 1, you get 10, which really means 2. The 100 means 4. 111 means 7. And somehow, this relates to base 8 and is going to do my homework for me. Then a curious thing. I sneak up on the 10 and remember the old carry the 1 routine. So I take 1. It won't fit. So I take 1, and if I add 1, that's what I'm trying to say to you, it won't fit in the first column. So you got to carry the 1 into the second column. And the second column, now a 10, is really a 2, I guess 10, on bizarro binary world. So 11 would really be the secret identity of 3. Whammo. The light bulb goes off like a firecracker in the top back of my head. I have to show you the illustration. Next day, I eat arithmetic alive. I've talked with other autists, sometimes similar stories. less intense maybe, but that internal craving for learning something new, part of pretty much every autist I've ever met so far. And in many ways, as exotic as it may sound, it's what every human experiences, just amplified and twisted about 5 degrees into the weird. We are hardwired for joy, autistic or not. Every good thing you do, eating, sleeping, shitting, making babies, helping an old lady across the street, solving problems, and learning something that's useful to you, comes with a little shot of joy juice, nature's reward for a job well done. You know what I mean? That rush you feel when the right jigsaw puzzle piece jumps right out at you after you search for an hour. That time you guessed the right spelling word and won, or eliminated the last false suspect and clue, solved those cool logic problems on the SATs. Hell, for me, any multiple choice test, IQs, the Ways, GEDs, every question, one bingo after another, high on dopamine, orgasmic. So maybe I never experienced that moment of learning again with such clarity and ecstasy. But each and every time, there's that faint echo, like chasing the ghosts of your first monster roller coaster or your first kiss. The excited squeals, the flapping hands, the jumping up and down. That's ecstasy. Look, not every autist experiences this pleasure the same way. But imagine that kind of intensity, that kind of joy, Ernest. There are times I think there's nothing we autists can't do. So it's time to give you my takeaways and wrap this up. It's going to take me a minute more. A little bit about how I learn. I have no training in educational theory, but I hope I give you some clues, something you'll know what to do with. Here's me learning. I experience thinking as a language is... Let's try that again. I experience thinking as a language of images, sensations, feelings, and metaphors, more than words, sentences, logic, symbols. My memories, they're not facts or words or judgments. They're more like dramatic scenes with location shots, characters, lighting, my costume, weather, what I felt. I relive them to remember. And I process thoughts almost like manipulating physical objects. Numbers are like blocks that snap together, fitting like Legos. Music, in my mind, vines and intertwines in space. I remember language more clearly when I handwrite or make notes in book margins. Things I can touch or imagine I can touch are most real to me. Memorizing words, symbols, nah. Get me into the process, the sensations. To some autistics, some of this will sound familiar. Like, you know, doesn't everybody? Others are more at home with symbolic logic. I learn differently than other folks. I need to understand. I need to co-invent. If I don't understand something from the inside, it doesn't exist for me. I learn new categories of knowledge somewhat slowly, like switching to base 8. Switching from clock faces to digital clocks, what a freaking nightmare. But once a new area opens up to me, I seem to associate the skills and the concepts with other related knowledge more rapidly than most folks, even come up with new solutions. supposedly thinking outside the box. The box blew the line, man. Take music, art, and literature. Rhythm, texture, line, shading, repetition, variation, direction, structure. Really, it's all pretty similar. I switch from one to another. For some, it's the same with math. Director Tim Burton might be autistic. He made Edward Scissorhands and The Nightmare Before Christmas. Physicist Albert Einstein might be too. He made Relativity. And shows up on the Brainy Quotes website a real lot. How we explain the ecstasy of that process to ourselves and others, probably different. How can we help today's autistic kids not to get lost in the system like I did? And it shouldn't matter what their capabilities are, whatever their special passions are. We need an autistic education centered on autistic natures. By engaging the power of autistic specializations and passions, and then building further, using those skills, concepts, and similarities to teach new areas. Not trying to make them learn like other brains learn. And by providing structure, to learning in a different way, by doing, using the joy of process rather than goals like tests or papers or A's or competition ranking. I was gifted. I was the freak because my disabilities were invisible. What school expected of me, more than I could handle. There's no question I came from privilege, and yet I was disabled. Even if so many of you listening or folks you care for are even more disabled. For myself, I don't compare disabilities. It's not a contest. I failed to thrive. Other gifted kids fail to thrive. I have no clue who suffers most. Does it matter? Look, there are groups of kids, for various reasons, that education marginalizes. There are kids suffering. Address their needs. School isn't a triage unit on a battlefield. We don't prioritize who survives and who doesn't. I hope. You see a kid in pain, deal with the pain. I thought I'd end on an important side point. I write about childhood experiences a lot with purpose. It's a great meeting ground. Who doesn't love kids? So parents of autistic kids, professional caretakers, and adult autists, when we share notes, childhood memories, experiences, and our own thoughts on them, you get a peek into the mysterious world your autistic child inhabits, the joys, the wonders, the fears, the challenges, the victories. And honestly, I write about kids because I get to turn again and again to my earliest memories to recover my own natural joy. May this generation never lose it. Okay, that's a wrap.
That's awesome. I'm sitting here in the dark. I had to do theater lighting. And like, I feel like I need to listen again and watch again to just peel back some of the layers, because we were seeing a lot of claps and hearts and, you know, just responses. And that's, I think, why I like listening to you so much. And I know this was hard to do live because you present such a polished, beautiful podcast, and you did a remarkable job. I'm like, to do that live is very hard, right, Maddie? Like, so hard.
I just want to say, Johnny, just blown away, honestly, every time listening to you. I have for a long while now, and your style, the words, just the backstory of you, it's such a privilege to have you here. And, you know, writing myself and spoken word and the sound of words, I'm just like...
Maddie, that means a lot.
Just taking it all in, man, you know, like future collaborations and stuff out of here, but it's such a pleasure, you know, honestly, man. I enjoyed that, and a lot to think about as well, so I'm just having such sensory joy with what I've just witnessed, and I'm sure everybody...
That's really cool. I mean, because feel like you're pissing into the void. You know what it feels like.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, in that stream of consciousness, and I felt that while you were doing it, and my style of things as well is really that authentic connection and trying to connect the thoughts. So doing it live, it's like this disconnect, right? But I felt you with it. I feel that in the way you express, and now it's a real joy and pleasure, man. But yeah, I feel you. It's surreal, isn't it? Very surreal. Yeah,
absolutely. I did feel naked without the reverb, I'll be honest.